The Cork Food Stories Podcast with Clara Cooney, Cork's Red FM.
Welcome to this week's Cork Food Podcast, where we talk to food suppliers and producers of Cork and have them share their wonderful stories with us. In general, here in Cork, there's a huge passion for all things food, whether it is shopping at our local markets, eating out in the amazing restaurants we have, cooking at home with families and friends, or getting your favourite foods delivered to your door. The past year has been a difficult one for the hospitality industry, and we've all looked at ways we can still support our local businesses while we can also have a little bit of that dine-in feeling in our homes. This week's guest is a well-known Cork businessman, Ernest Cantillon, who at the age of 22 took a leap of faith and opened his first bar, Sober Lane, and then in 2011 opened Electric Bar and Restaurant. He ventured into the Dublin market for a few years and then decided to focus thoroughly on Cork. He also has a very successful events company and also is the director of Kinsale Spirits, which we will talk about in detail in a little while. Ernest, welcome to Cork Food Stories. Great to have you on.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Looking forward to this.
Not at all. Now, if you've listened to a couple of my podcasts, I always like to go back a little bit and talk to, you know, talk to people about their own upbringing. So you're definitely somebody who was born with an entrepreneurial spirit starting at such a young age, and both your parents successful with Cantillon Solicitors as well. I would imagine you got some of that passion from them. So, but what was it like, Ernest, as a child growing up for you?
It's funny, actually. Everyone assumed that my mum worked with my dad, and she didn't. She was a successful solicitor in her own right, so I think I owe her that to say it. But funnily enough, my brother and my sister are now partners in my dad's office. So I'm myself and one other brother were the only two who didn't go into the law thing. But I suppose my dad, they celebrated 40 years a couple of years ago, so he was in his 20s when he went out on his own as well anyway. So I guess, some of us deviate or away from what our parents do, whatever, but I suppose you certainly kind of, get used to that environment. So my dad was certainly always self-employed for all my lifetime, and that's all I kind of knew, you know. So for better or for worse, I suppose the freedom of taking holidays whenever he wanted, but then in the same breath, like, he still leaves home at 6:15 every morning, you know, like, and 40, however many years on, and it's rare that he's home before 7. So, like, pros and cons, but that was kind of all I knew. So I always kind of thought I might end up working for myself, and I probably always thought I was going to be a solicitor or lawyer as well. Just when I got a bit older and did work experience there a few summers and even went to college, I just realized, you know, being in an office just wasn't for me.
I know. And, you know, I think just like you know as well, we're the same. Like, I did go into office work to begin with in HR, but all of us have taken after our own dad and gone down the self-employment and entrepreneurial. And I definitely think your parents have an effect on you, especially, I suppose, when you're making that initial decision and having the support behind it and even that push to go on, do it, just give it a go and see how it goes. And I think, Ernest, like, you did e-commerce first, didn't you, in UCC, and then you
did commerce, yeah. There was no e-commerce back then, I don't think. 20 years ago, just commerce, I think. There was the internet of sorts, but yeah, nothing like that.
And then you also did chefing, didn't you? Did you do a course in chefing?
I did. I did for Fall Darling for, it was about a year-long course. I really enjoyed it. I certainly wouldn't call myself a chef by any stretch of the imagination, but that was it'd be the equivalent of year one, which is now Culinary Arts in CAT, or MTU, I think it's called, or something like that.
Yeah, it is MTU,
So I realised quickly that being a chef was really, really hard work.
Yeah.
And I still love food and would have no problem mucking in the kitchen, but I wouldn't, I'd be able to make most things for you, but could I make 50 of them in 15 minutes? Definitely not. You know, I just wouldn't have the pace. So I think that is the difference between somebody who can cook and a chef, you know what I mean? That's
I agree completely with you, absolutely. And like, you were a very young age. I mean, you decided at 22 to look at investing into a bar. And at that time, we all know at 22, most people are only interested in being on one side of the bar. So tell us a bit about kind of how that all came about. Because I know your dad played a part in that as well, and really, you know, pushing at you to invest fully into sober lanes.
In every way.
So tell us about that.
So I was probably 23 when we opened, but I was 22 when we did the deal to buy the building. So I when I finished college, and I went to school young, so I was in college when I was 17, I think. So I started managing a bar, and I'd never even really worked in a bar. When I say managing, it was a small bar. There was just maybe two or three of us on the staff, and I was oldest, so I was the manager. That's how it kind of worked. But it's gone now. It was Olden's Butcher Shop that became a bar called Cleaver's, which was on Liberty Street.
And okay, then, very good.
After my time, it became Cannabis, and now I think it's Impala, which is a very successful bar in its own right, doing all sorts of craft beer and cool things. But which I really enjoyed it. It was something I had never done. There's no hospitality in my family background. Funnily enough, of my generation of cousins, lots of us have since gone into it, which is interesting. But and the guys who owned it asked me to become a partner. And I suppose my dad said, look, if you're going to do this, I'm happy to back you. If you want to, you know, if you feel you can do it for somebody else, why not do it for yourself? And so we did, and I suppose I'm very lucky that he was in a position to get me started, you know, to give me a deposit and to back me with the bank, because I still don't know if I'd be in the position to have done it otherwise. Definitely not then, and maybe not ever. So it was lucky, I guess, that that he was able to, and also I suppose that he'd been self-employed and saw that as a viable route. And it's funny, so when you were saying it a while ago, I've greatly enjoyed being self-employed. I don't doubt me, I've been stressful. Like, my God, jobs are a person. And I have two small kids, and I don't know if I would recommend it to them, you know, being self-employed. I've loved it, but I just it's funny. I think Faroe Hills are green. You know, you think that people who maybe aren't self-employed turn off the phone at 5 o'clock every evening, which of course they don't. You know, they're probably not as hard as anybody else.
No,
that's just a Faroe Hills are green thing. But it's just when you were saying it there, I was thinking, geez, I don't think my parents ever recommended it to me. I just made up my own mind, but, you know, maybe that's what people have to do, but it's funny. I've never given it that much thought, so it's interesting.
Yeah, they probably didn't. It's not that recommendation kind of thing. I think it's just that, you know, the support that's there. So when you make that decision, it was like, well, I was in corporate life for a long time, but when I decided to give it all up and go into self-employment, you know, it was the support that was there and the push and the drive to go do it. Just give it a go. See if it works. Yeah. And I think that helps tremendously. Knowing that you have the support of your family behind you when you're starting off as self-employment. So
I was young, so I suppose I had no dependents. I had no house mortgage, you know. And if I kicked on for a couple of years and it hadn't worked out, I kind of felt, okay, I have a degree, you know. I am it's still in Cork, so like it's a moving location, and I am I can dust myself off and, you know, get a job.
Exactly, absolutely. But you didn't have to do that. So, I mean, that was just the beginning, because it was
not yet.
But that was the beginning, because then you had a course, Electric, which I think was 2011, wasn't it, when you opened Electric? Is that right? Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Which is the bar and the fish restaurant. And
some 10th anniversary we're having, but anyway.
Oh, I know, Ernest. But look, the roaring 20s for this century is upon us. And, you know, it'll be good to be able to reopen again. I know, absolutely. But Electric has been a very successful bar. I've been there plenty of times myself for food and the occasional night out as well. You decided, I suppose, the bar was one thing, but just to get into the restaurant. But was it always something that you felt, right, okay, the bar is one thing, but now I want to move into the restaurant side of things?
There was kind of two things. For one, I suppose we opened it in like peak recession. So it was originally, I bought it to be a late bar, actually, more a late bar than a nightclub, but a late night venue.
Yeah.
And then just when I got to know the building got better, and it's got so many windows looking out over the park and the river and stuff, thought it'd be a nicer food venue. I suppose, like, to a large extent, it was Sober Lane was making that happen, as in paying the bills. So I didn't want to cannibalize, you know, they're very near each other. So I didn't want to cannibalize the Sober Lane business.
Yeah.
That was going really well then. It still is, thankfully. So it kind of had to be everything that Sober Lane wasn't. So Sober Lane is student, Electric isn't. Sober Lane wasn't really into cocktails back then. So Electric was. Overlay was casual food, Lecter was more formal food. There's 15 or 16 televisions in Sober Lane. Electric usually is none. I say usually because sometimes we get them for Cheltenham or something like that. But yeah. So it's a different pitch. And I suppose it became a much bigger business than Sober Lane in some ways, that more employees, more tables, more people. So then it kind of took over. It became from, I suppose, not being another business to my main focus. It was a roller coaster because we've changed what we've done there over the years a few times, and we're actually changing a lot at the moment. I suppose without getting into too much detail, the electric that reemerges when we reopen will be quite different. It's going to look quite different on the inside and probably the outside, and the style of food and drinks offering and everything is going to be different. So
amazing.
I hope it works because it's a fairly dramatic change, but look, let's see what happens.
But you know, you did change over the years, and I remember it when it first opened, it was just a fish bar, and then you extended the menu. And I mean, I've had brunch there with the girls, you know, I've also been up sitting at the bar having just a fish supper or whatever. So it's always worked, Ernest, even all the changes you did make. And of course, you've gorgeous, you're in a perfect location there, right in the center of the city. And you've a lovely, you're spoiled. That outdoor area you have for summer is just spot on. It really is. It's fantastic. So, I mean, besides electric, you did decide that you wanted to go to Dublin. You tried you did open Sober Lane in Dublin for a few years.
We were there for 2 years. Yeah, 2 years.
And tell us a little.
It was a tough 2 years. Yeah.
Business was
okay up there. I just personally, I found it quite tough. In that, I suppose just the commute and. Yeah. I probably didn't realize how hands-on I was, kind of that informal, passively being there, you know, in the bars every evening and stuff, and it was quite hard to run them remotely. I had very good staff and an electric, I had a business partner at the time, but still, it was tricky. And then in Dublin, I suppose I just didn't have the network that I had in Cork or in the city that well.
Yeah.
And I suppose a couple of months in, I realized that I'd probably bought the wrong location. It was a really nice bar and a nice location, but extremely quiet footfall-wise, even though on paper looks next near lots of things like the Aviva Stadium and Sandy Mountain, but just not near enough. And I also went with the wrong pitch. I should have gone for a more serious food offering there. But I went almost, you know, gastro bar, but I went for Sober Lane offering. And it just didn't really click. We tipped away, like we paid the bills, but it just, you know, it didn't. I'm very lucky Sober Lane Electric hit the ground running. And we have been very busy since the off, and that wasn't. And that kind of, I suppose, knocked my confidence a bit, to be honest.
Yeah.
So that took a bit of the fun out of it. You know, then you're slugging along and trying to change something while it's up and operating, especially not that, if you're busy, it's not that hard to change because you have confidence and the customer has confidence in you and they kind of change with you.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have a place that isn't going particularly well, it's hard to justify pumping more money into the thing to turn it around. But we were, that's kind of at the stage we were at. We're going to convert it more to kind of like a restaurant. There's some really good gastro-y places around there, like the Chop House, things like that, the old spot opened. So I had a business partner in Electric since we opened, and he gave me the opportunity to buy him out. And it was a very amicable deal. We'd still be great friends and colleagues as well, and they would ask each other for advice a lot. But I'd ask him for advice anyway. He didn't ask me for any, but we, so I kind of had, I couldn't, physically or financially, I had to pick between the two. And like my plan was always to come back to Cork. And so I did, and we sold it. And we're lucky in that it was in a rising market. So I think we bought in 2013 and maybe sold in 2015 or something like that. So so we got good money for it. So kind of all's well that ends well. And it was an itch I had to, well, I didn't have to scratch, but I just, as far as it was green, I thought it was a good idea. And
I was just going to say,
to do it again, like, you know.
Yeah, if you didn't try it, you see, these things would always be playing on your mind as well. So, you know, I think it's good. But you're right, that commute constantly. And because was one of your children born at that stage?
No. And that was kind of on the whole. We opened and we wanted to start a family. And I just knew we couldn't be living in separate cities. I'm sure lots of people do it successfully, but I'd say it's hard. So that certainly made the decision to come back to Electric, you know, and Sober Lane easier.
Absolutely, of course. Look, I know it's been a very difficult 12 months for the hospitality and for you guys as well, opening and closing. There's been lots of change. There's been takeaways, no takeaways. So How have you coped, Dernis? How have you managed it all?
It's funny, I've been asked that question a few times recently, and you're nearly, it's a bit different because I suppose lots of people listen to this, but you're always trying to gauge what experience you think the other person has had during COVID before you answer. So
yeah,
I suppose luckily for me, there's been no dire, you know, financial hardship, and nobody close to me has got sick. Lots of people know I've got the virus, but nobody has, you know, died or had long lasting effects.
Yeah.
So, and we've tried a few things that have worked, you know, sober lanes, take away food offering and different things like that. So for me, it was extremely stressful at the start. And I can, you know, I suppose I'm good enough at kind of getting on with it. Then after a while, I suppose again, maybe that's the difference, except I just have to. So we, I probably 2 weeks of being stressed the max and just said, okay, we need to figure this out. So then I, you know, we didn't have huge creditors, and with Bank of Ireland a long time, a really good relationship with them. We owned both the buildings, you know, so that I had a lot of power over it rather than dealing with landlords. So I was kind of mastering my own fate. So I said, okay, first step, just minimizing all expenses, you know, small things like, but like, you know, defrost the freezers and plug them out, so we're not running up electricity bills and whatever else. And a lot of our suppliers have been a very long time. So I suppose some urgent needed money, others didn't. And we just tried to balance that out. Similarly with staff.
Yeah.
Tried to make plans. So we, after a couple, maybe 2 or 3 months, I suppose we said, okay, what can we do? You know, what's viable here and what's not. And it's funny, in some ways I like to tear in and be first and things, then others I kind of want to see what was going on, you know. So I saw people doing takeaway food and selling things online or whatever else. So we didn't do a whole lot during the first lockdown. We reopened a little while after everybody else, maybe 2 weeks. I just wanted to see what was going on. Trade was really good. It was very enjoyable. People were delighted to be out. So that was nice. And then when the second lockdown came, which was maybe September or October, we kept Soberlane's done takeaway food since then, and it's been really busy. We always did a little bit of regulars would ring in, and we tried Deliveroo when it came out first, and their infrastructure just wasn't great with people getting cold food and stuff. But we did a lot of research, and thankfully it's exceptionally busy for takeaway food in Soberlane. So we, even to the extent where we're trying to figure out how to make that compatible with our, you know, when we go back to we don't want to hop from one back to the other, you know, we want to try and combine both.
Have a plan.
Then with electric, we had a cracking summer for the few months we were open, and we have dipped in and out. So we came up with these cocktail selection boxes for Christmas. They went really well. And again, we said, okay, that's enough money out to pay the bills for, say, January and February. We dipped in for 2 weeks and did a special offer for Valentine's, and that went really well. Much better than expected, to be honest, because like everyone does gifting for Christmas, but I didn't know what happened for Valentine's. And now we have a crowdfunding campaign about to go live in about 3 weeks, maybe. And that's just, if we can reach certain targets, then we're going to bring out a new range of cocktails with different packaging and just have a bit of fun with it. Basically, people prepay for them, and if enough people do, we'll bring them out and we'll send them all out, and if they don't, everyone gets the money back. So it's kind of, I suppose we're just trying to see if the demand is out there before we go off and create 500 or 5,000 of these things.
Absolutely.
When we don't have the money to get around. So it's been a very interesting time.
And because you decided, Ernest, not to open at Christmas, like some of the bars around Cork. I mean, where was you? Was it just because you felt, I suppose, taking staff on and leaving them off again, or
there was a few things around one, I suppose personally, I just didn't really want to. I know that's a selfish answer, but it's the honest answer. I there was the first Christmas in 15 years off with two small boys at home was very exciting, you know, and enticing. My staff felt the same. They were really up for the summer opening. They weren't up for that opening at all. We had some cases of coronavirus in Soberlane in September, and while thankfully everyone recovered, it wasn't fun. You know, it wasn't fun for the people who got it, and I suppose we're trying to manage it reputationally in every other way, you know. So, and I just, I also didn't really feel the business was out there. I thought there was going to be a lot of cancellations and things like that. And okay, you can safeguard with deposits, but it still doesn't leave you a good experience with somebody. You know, if any time I've ever got a, you know, if I've had a non-refundable deposit and I haven't been able to go ahead with the thing on a personal level, regardless of the terms and conditions, I kind of feel ripped off. You know, like, so I just, I didn't want to get into that situation. So we we decided to go, the government had indicated they would keep the supports going, and then at the last minute didn't. So that was frustrating. So it was financially for business and personally was an expensive decision, but I'm glad we did because everyone had a nice Christmas. Nobody got sick. We thankfully, I think our, for whatever reason, because actually the mindset, but the, like our, even when places open, our takeaway food and our cocktails were busier. I thought when everyone opened, that kind of demand for those offerings might fall away. And they didn't, they increased eventing.
I know.
And to my colleagues, yeah, they were only busy for maybe, they'd maybe 10 busy nights. So by the time we stocked up and all that kind of stuff, I don't know, would we have made any money? Don't think we would have.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, like, look, I had a couple of lunches out now. I went to the Dean to see what it was like. And but I didn't do much nights out. But a lot of people were really just interested in actually getting the takeaways and having them at home with friends and family.
Yeah.
It was so nice to be able to do that. You felt safer doing it that way. And I know we have been actually quite spoilt in Cork. We've got lots of options for different types of takeaways. You know, even just your
There's amazing ones, yeah.
Amazing ones that are out there, and I think there's been quite a few new little businesses that have been created through it all as well. Yeah. So,
I don't know if you've talked to, I can't think of his name. Is it Brian? Maybe I don't know him. The guy who was the glass curtain, but he was really
Brian.
Busy.
That's right.
I got it a few times, and it was a really good offering. That his takeaway kind of par cooked thing, and he had nice touches like a. It was a recommended Spotify playlist thing with it, and it was just a really good experience.
And it's funny, it was, as well, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was maybe 50 quid for two, 40 quid for two, and then he'd fancy wraps there were 50 quid for two. So not that cheap, but after I had it, I was like, it really felt that it was a good value. You know, and I think Good Day Denny have just kicked off again doing stuff, and I'm mad to try that because one of my favourite places.
I know.
Liberty Grill is a few things about to launch. So there's even still innovation going on.
There is
lots of cool things going, yeah.
And I love Good Day Deli as well. We had my mum's 70th and in the summertime, and we were all set up outside in the garden, and we got greens to take away. It was fantastic. It took away all.
Yeah, Brian and the team are brilliant. Yeah.
Oh, it was so good. So really enjoyable. I agree with you, and I think that is going to continue for a long time. Even when the doors open. I think businesses will, like yourself as well, Ernest, will start to look at how you can have a blend of both.
It's a nice way to socialise. I think people have kind of that, the going in and staying out kind of comes in out of, I think we're probably around the same age group. I can certainly remember, it was all about town, and then the millennium happened, and taxis were 50 quid in place for charging door money, and you couldn't get in. A lot of people said, check this, was stay at home. And New Year's Eve used to be a really good night in town, and then for 10 years at least it wasn't. And then the last 2 years, New Year's Eve has started being a really good night in town again. So, you know, things kind of come in cycles. It's funny.
It does indeed. Besides that and all the restaurants and bars, you also opened an events company focusing on food festivals. What's it called again? The Burger Fest, isn't it? Is that it?
But a few goes off that, I suppose. Where that came from is that... I did some food festivals in Fitzgerald's Park, and I really enjoyed them. That was maybe, I think, what was called Taste Fest, one was called Food Fest or something like that. But we had about 20,000 people through the park over a weekend. It was a great buzz. That's like, you think coronavirus is stressful. Trying to arrange that is stressful. a great way to lose lots of money. But very enjoyable. And we did. Oktoberfest, which was in the grounds of Beamish Crawford, that for 6 years, and that was, so I suppose what happened is when I went to do Soberlin Dublin, I took a step back from that stuff, and I suppose I still love events, but I just didn't have the appetite for the financial risk or all the work to put on a physical one. And also the good thing about these festivals are great, however, invariably they just replicate costs for business. So I have electric there, I'm open and I'm paying my staff, whatever. And then we have to pay for a stand at the food fest, and we have to pay for staff there. And town is probably quiet because everyone's at the festival. And I said, geez, I wonder if we could come up with a concept for festivals to bring business to, the businesses. So that's where, we did a number of festivals. We did a burger festival, 2 or 3 years went down really well, a whiskey festival, a dessert festival, and we did most of them around Cork, and then we did one or two of them nationally. So like the whiskey one probably was my, the burger one was, did what it said in the tin. All these bars and restaurants had, you know, special burgers of the week, and it went really well.
Yeah.
And then there were, when I say, it wasn't a business really, we made feck all money over it. We just organized it, but it just created a buzz that it, we usually did them in January and November. Yeah. There was nothing else gone. Totally, but the whiskey one, for example, was a really nice one in that a lot of distilleries from outside Cork got involved and came and did talks and tastings. And like we had one event in Electric where we had a chocolate maker, a barista or a coffee roaster and a distiller. So they were, you know, going through all the different flavors that say whiskey, coffee and chocolate and all different combinations can have. So you have chocolate liqueurs, you have Irish coffees. So you have all those things. And so I do enjoy, and it's definitely something I'll revisit.
Brilliant.
I think the last one we did was a National Burger Festival. And when they get to a certain scale, you need to start having, you know, sponsors for them. And
it
takes a life of its own. And I suppose there's only so many hours in the day. It's a pity I enjoyed the festivals, I must say, but just trying to fit everything in is the challenge.
They're a great buzz. And look, we have, did you have anything to do with the long table on the South Mall?
We were there. We weren't
amazing
the first year, but we were at three, so there was no last year. So we're in the three before that. So in fairness, I think they did do a hamper or something last year, a picnic hamper. For the long ones. And we saw, say, we were wearing our Electric hat and then wearing our Concession hat as well.
Yeah, exactly. And also you've got Taste Cork, and I know that there's plans on that coming, hopefully for the end of the year, fingers crossed, not fully confirmed yet, but all going well, we might be able to have a little festival in the City Hall, which would be fantastic as well. So
it'll be super.
Super. And I think that those kind of things are just that mentality of, oh my God, that could be happening. That's brilliant. It's something for us to all start to look forward to as well.
Look forward to big time. Big time.
So the event's brilliant. Love it. And now what I really want to talk to you about really is about Kinsale Spirit Company. And I think it started, Ernest, as Kinsale Gin. Am I right? In 2015?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So tell me about that. Yeah. Is it with Tom and Colin you set that up with?
Exactly. So it was Tom's baby, Tom Reardon, and Tom now owns The Raven, which is probably one of my favourite bars.
Love it.
So when I came back from Dublin, I was planning on coming back anyway. He said, look, Tom has lived in Kinsale for a very long time. He said, look, myself and my sister Claude are working in the city to bring out a gin brand. We'd also like to do a whiskey, but that's going to be a longer plan. Would you like to be involved? I said, yeah, I'd love to. Great. So that's where it kicked off. So our first batch was just 100 bottles. We sold them in Bradley's on our main street. They've always supported us. And it went well. And then I suppose we've just scaled up. So we actually, at the moment, we're planning promotion. We're about to sell our 100,000 bottles. We're trying to come up with a promotion for it to be, to track where it's sold and when, so we can, you know, do a nice prize for the person. But it's like, fantastic. Look, I'm sure Gardens and Corkridge didn't probably sell that in a day. But for us, that's a big number. And every year it's, you know, sales have gone up or more than doubled or whatever. So,
that's huge. Yeah. It's only what, 5 years, 6 years old?
And it's really, to be fair, we, about two years ago, time seems hard to judge with this virus crack, but it was getting to the stage where we said, okay, we're on something here. We were both busy. Tom was after renovating The Raven. We said, look, we really think this thing, if we could give it more time and resources, it would, you know, it would thrive. So Colin Ross, who had Clancy's for years and had worked for Heineken originally, so he had experience in the drinks business and some other projects in the States.
Brilliant.
He became a partner with us and he drove it on in a big way. So we got the whiskey to market, started exporting, had some good luck with fundraising rounds. So it's kind of a big year for us in that things are happening apace in both China and in
the US.
America. Yeah, we've really just connected with Super Value, and we just, I suppose, at a management level, get on with them. They're just a pleasure to deal with, and they've kind of nurtured us. So we're in, I think, 156 Super Values or something like that.
Yeah,
now.
They're amazing.
We're working our way up the country. We're just talking Super Value Northern Ireland. So there's loads of nice things going on. We have two more whiskies out in July, hopefully. So there's lots going on there. So it's a very exciting time. And I don't think all those things that I've listed will work or keep going, but if even one or two of them kind of kick off, you know, where it'll give us momentum to drive it on.
It will, of course. So now, just a little bit of background for everyone listening, Ernest, just around, the, I think it's a 22 botanicals of Kinsale using your gins. Talk a little bit about the gin, sure. And kind of how it came about. Yeah.
So I suppose Kinsale being iconic and a really scenic, you know, so it's good for marketing and all that. And lots of people have really nice memories of it, you know. You'd really always want to sail on a night out or a holiday or a weekend, be it Chips and Dino's or exploring the old head or whatever. So we said, okay, like powerful imagery and brand, and at the same breath, like a real, like a bastion famous for food and drink, going all the way back to Keith Floyd and whatever else.
Yeah.
So there's that, and you've lots of good chocolate companies. There's other good, you have Blacks there making good spirits and beers, you have the mead people. So there's lots of good food and drink things coming from
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I suppose it's still countryside, so there's lots of good natural ingredients. So they're challenging because some of them are wild and they're seasonal. So so we're watching the weather at the moment and going, I wonder when the Alexander seeds are going to be out now. You know, like, so there's all this kind of stuff goes on. And like foraging is fine for the 100 bottle run, but foraging for the, you know, when you're doing 20,000 bottles in a run is... presents its challenges.
So
I suppose it's trying to be, you know, realistic and scale up and still be true to the roots. No, I suppose we've got a bit clever in that some of the stuff that we used to forage, we're now growing, you know, it can sell, albeit in some of the guys' gardens and stuff. But so we tried probably up to, it was Tom really and his sister Clodagh, they did 5 liter still, probably tried up to 100 distillations in Clodagh's kitchen. And Tom was bringing the batches each night into the Raven and kind of had a group of, I suppose, looking back, they're testers, but there was no informal name on them, just people like gin.
People who like gin.
Yeah, exactly. So there was people saying, oh, I love it, but it doesn't really taste like gin. You know, it's got that junipery taste. Or, yeah, it's nice, but it tastes like anything else. Or so, and then there was things, like we wanted to include a seaweed, but we just couldn't get the flavour to match.
Yeah.
I think some other people have done it. Maybe the Cape Clear one, see, but some of them are barer. But for us, we just couldn't get it to match the taste profile, you know, just to click. So anyway, I think it was we probably went all the way up to 100. It came back in like, I think it was the 67th distillation or something like that was the magic one. And we knew that it was different, which is good and bad. You know, like if you take a lot of the big selling gins, there's not that much variation in them. And
yeah.
That's okay. That's obviously what people want and expect. But we knew we had to be different. So I wouldn't go as far as to say it's Marmite, I love it or hate it, but it is noticeably different.
Okay.
It's very citrusy. You would certainly know that there's a lot of flavours in it. You know, it's not just coriander, juniper and something else. There's hence the 21 botanicals. And there's in the background, there's a few interesting little bits and pieces of it. So for example, there's lemons and limes in it, black lemons, which actually, they call black lemons, are dried limes. Things like that we're not going to grow in Kinsale because they're not going to, you know, they're not the climate. So Claude and Tom's sister worked in Bahrain for a long time, had good relationships with people out there still. So we sourced them from there. So we try and, you know, how the behind each botanical is probably a little story or nuance as well.
Absolutely. And I suppose, Ernest, as well, you know, gin has become so popular. I love gin. I know a lot of people. I mean, you go into a bar now and there could be 15, 20 different bottles of gin to choose from. So was it difficult for you? I know you were all in the trade, so you had your contacts, but breaking the Irish market, was it difficult to start off with?
It's funny, what I would say was our advantage, and I'd say it was probably our disadvantage, and that we focused a huge amount on the on-trade. And that was large because we had friends and colleagues in the pub trade who were really supportive. Don't get me wrong, we wouldn't have come this far without them. But we neglected the off-trade. We neglected, you know, supermarkets and off-licenses.
Yeah.
And I know COVID's a bit different because obviously there is no pubs and supermarkets are very busy. But we definitely should have had a two-pronged approach and approached the retail sooner just because it's been really good for us, you know. And I suppose a bar orders a bottle at a time where a supermarket orders three or four cases at a time.
Absolutely.
So, it's a learning curve. I wouldn't say we'd do it differently because thankfully so far it's worked out and I'm happy that and it was a nice gentle learning curve. You know, like largely because we didn't have the time or resources to give it to grow it any faster, it grew slowly at the start, which was great because it was like whatever about the liquid, trying to figure out the packaging and the barcodes,
of course,
and how we export and all the licenses and when or if we should build a distillery. You know, all these things are any one of those wrong decisions could sink you, like, you know.
Absolutely. And because you've got, okay, so you started with the gin and then you brought the whiskey in. How many, is it one or two whiskeys? Do you have a couple of whiskeys?
So
one whiskey at the moment.
So we planned to launch in March last year, and then COVID hit and we said, okay, and then we realized after a week or two, I'm going to say this could go on forever. Let's, you know, when I say forever, 6 months a year.
Yeah.
So let's launch anyway and see what happens. You know, like, so we launched and it just got good traction. I suppose we said, I think we put together maybe 250 mini bottles and said online, look, who would like to try this in all these whiskey forums and whatever else, and lots of people said, yeah, me. So we sent it out to Ireland and further afield, and we just got good feedback. So there was no, I suppose if it was for COVID, we probably would have said, okay, should we take a billboard? Should we do radio ads? You know, whatever. But we didn't do any of that just because it was such an uncertain time. And it's been a very organic launch and growth. But I suppose it's distinct branding. It's a unique, fairly unique finish in the Rioja casks that ties all into the story. And it's just, I think it's well-priced at €35. So it's going well. And I suppose we're also, as I said, that super value relationship has really paid off because they're extremely busy because of COVID and we're lucky enough that they give us good shelf space and stuff.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
That's nice. Yeah, it's exciting.
It's great. And it's a gorgeous label. And of course, it's another story of the history of Kinsale behind that one as well, which is fabulous. And 35 is very good. I mean, My dad, now he loves his, God, and my brother-in-law, they all love their drop of whiskey. And, you know, you have the likes of, I suppose, the Black Barrel that's out there. That's around the 45, 50 euro kind of thing that a lot of people get. You've the Jameson IPA. And, of course, the Red Breast is another beautiful one. But that's double the price of yours then, you know. So
We're lucky in that, I suppose, it's a very vibrant market at the moment out there. There's lots of whiskeys coming out. And while some people would say that makes it more competitive, it does. But also, there's lots of interest about Irish whiskey and people are investing in it and people are setting up clubs. And I think people are very inclined to try a new whiskey. You know, to see the label and they go, okay. I think once it's under 50 quid, you go, okay, I'll take it.
Yeah, I'll try it.
I'll try it, you know. And if it's in a retailer, a big retailer like the Trust, you know, like a good off license or super, I'm sure it's of a certain standard. Let's take a punt. A bit like people would have done with wine or do with craft beers. I think they're doing that with whiskey now. Like, you know?
Absolutely, they are indeed. And so the last year, off you go international to the US and China. Amazing. Well done. That's just fantastic.
Thank you. We had some, I suppose, again, like we've just had some luck with China. There was a really good guy in the city council for a very long time called Pat Ledwich, and he was very involved in Cork's partnership with Shanghai and really built up a good Chinese network for that. So he has been a really good mentor for us and has, you know, connected us people that know him, we can trust, and it's just taken, I suppose, the risk out of it. So we've built a good relationship there. And then in the US, we entered this every year at the Bartender Spirits Award, where they send out samples of these whiskies to kind of the top bartenders in the US. And they picked our gin as best gin, which was just mighty.
Amazing.
So, yeah, it's funny. At the time, we didn't get a whole lot of press here. We had a good win a couple of years ago. We won best in Ireland, then became top 10 in the world in the World Gin Awards, which was great. And we got lots of press out of it. But with this one, we didn't, because it actually happened like just at peak COVID. But for the, when I say the people that matter, the people who run bars and stuff in the States, they would have taken notice of it. So when we are now knocking on doors, we just did a deal last week for distribution in Colorado for a company. And the fact that we had won the award, it has a lot of credibility. They say, look, we haven't heard of your brand, but every year we stock any of the brands that win at that award. So, you know, you just need those twists of luck. You need things to go your way.
Yeah, and do you know, it's true as well, though, that a lot of Americans come to visit. They visit Kinsale. So that would have probably kind of an emotional attachment with them as well, you know, when they see the brand, which is fantastic.
So we've launched in Newport, Rhode Island, and Newport is twinned with Kinsale, and there's a really active connection between the two. So
amazing.
Pre and post COVID, every year the chefs come back and forth, do restaurant takeovers, and like Kinsale would be really well known in Newport, and so it's a really nice town. It's similar to Kinsale, and it's kind of a beachhead, no pun intended, for us, just into that market. And our plan was really to go over there and, you know, go over in the Kinsale delegation, going over and put boots on the ground and figure it out.
Yeah.
And COVID has really led to us, I suppose, doing more stuff online and,
I know,
and through Zoom or whatever over there. But we're still really excited about that. I suspect they'll probably come over here next rather than us go over there. They go back and forth. But I'd say the Americans will be traveling this way before we'll be traveling
before
that
we will. I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. And was it only was it Friday that you had a container going out to China?
So it was our second container, but it was our first. So the other one, we were mad to do, you know, a photo of it and stuff, because it was actually leaving from Cork. But again, the first one, just with COVID and stuff, there was no chance of actual photos and whatever. Where this was nice because it was the actual container. And I know, look, they all look the same on the outside, but for us, it was cool to see it going on the boat and all that.
Yeah, how exciting. So, it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. And it's a bit surreal because I've never been to China. You know, like I barely think on the map. But when you get the email saying, look, the product's so well, please send us more. You know, you're saying, okay. And it was the first time, when it went in a container, it was only half a container of our products. And whereas this is nearly all our products, which is nice. So they're good quantities. Like, you know,
it's fantastic. I would have never have gone, oh yeah, China is a really good export market for gin and whiskies. I wouldn't have thought of it. So it was
it's
really
just
good
to
see.
Off, to be honest. Yeah. It's just, non-Chinese spirits or spirits outside China still only account for like 2% of their drinks market.
Wow.
But I suppose 2% of a billion drinkers is still good news.
Exactly.
Like, you know?
Exactly it is. And so you're planning on building, so where are you distilling at the moment, actually?
So our whiskey comes from the Great Northern Distillery, which would be owned by Mr. Teeling, the father of the guys in Dublin. And we've really good relationship with them. And I suppose whiskey's a bit different in that, like, while the whiskey's only out a year, that relationship has gone back 5 years, because it was 3 or 4 years in the making. So whereas the gin from day one has come from West Cork Distillers, and in all likelihood, even when we have our own distillery, hopefully volumes going the way they're going, the majority will still come from those partners anyway.
Okay.
But we'd like just to have our own premises, to do special releases, to have a tourist attraction, and just, I suppose, to connect more strongly with Kinsale.
So that's the plan. You've got a piece of land there. It's down at Sandy Cove, is it? Or is it what's called again?
Yeah, quite near.
We're
in planning at the moment. Yeah.
And do you think that will be looking at maybe this year that you'll be starting?
I hope we'll have activity there by the end of the summer, because we actually have a lot of the equipment bought and everything. We bought our gin still just a couple of months ago now and stuff like that. So we've been buying bits as we go along. So really, it's just getting the planning and getting going, like, you know.
Yeah, because that'll be fantastic, even just for employment and everything down in Kinsale.
Oh, big
time. So it'll be great.
Yeah, it'll be two full-time new jobs as well, out of the traps probably, as well as our existing crew.
Exactly.
I think there's 9 of us in Kinsale Spirit now. So it's grown, you know, there are some nice jobs there. It's good.
Which will be great. Well, you see how well the tours go in the Jameson Distillery. So, you know, it would be lovely to have something down in Kinsale. I think it'd be very popular. And actually, Irish people love doing those things as well. It's not just for the tourists.
Oh,
so
whiskey tourism is
big, I love
big
it.
Business.
Yeah, big business, exactly. That's fantastic. So, Ernest, just on purchasing your products, they're all in Super Value across 130-odd stores across Ireland.
Yeah.
But people can...
A lot of the centres,
exactly, because they're all part of the Musgrave Group, yeah. And But people can... purchase online, can't they, as well, through Kinsale Spirit Company?
Kinsale Spirit, yeah, exactly, through our website. And we're in lots of the carryouts, lots of the really good independent off-licenses like Bradley's. Thankfully, there was a time when it was hard to find. It's increasingly easy to find, which is good.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay. So besides all of this Ernest, because you're, you know, you're not busy enough. You're also part of, you love doing the non for profit stuff. I know that. I know you did a lot of work with stuff with Dress for Success, but you're also on the board of Cork Simon Community, which works with men and women who, like, past or present issues with homelessness. Are even at risk for future homelessness. So I know that you've done an awful lot of work supporting them. I remember you were doing the nights out and stuff. Is it the sleep outs for fundraising?
Yes.
But you're on the board. So tell people, I suppose, a little bit about, I suppose it's been a very difficult year for homelessness over the last year. But how can people help, or how can people, you know, do anything at the moment around donations and fundraising?
I suppose that most of our campaigns have moved online, thankfully, relatively successfully. Simon would have had a lot of, you know, interactive, be it from people calling on the streets, you know, collecting on the streets to events that you could go to, a very successful annual dinner, all these things. So I suppose things like that were low. But I think we have a really, really good fundraising team there. And at Cork, by population divided by money raised, even for us, or by total charities, we're one of the most generous counties in Ireland. According to the stats, not in a flattering the audience kind of way.
Yeah.
We're phenomenal givers. And I suppose Cork Simon is 50 years old this year.
Yeah.
And people wouldn't know it going all the way back to when it was just soup runs, you know, to our shelters. And now our big thing at the moment is Housing First, which is, as you said, when people are in risk, at risk of homelessness.
Yeah.
You know, creating a home for them. And I think while it's not yet a constitutional right, we and Simon, probably lots of people, believe that having a home is a right, you know, it's a basic human need.
Yeah.
And we've realized that by the time you're providing emergency shelter for somebody, like, I suppose you failed, you know, like, say, you failed with, like, preventing homelessness, or at least reducing the gaps of somebody is.
Yeah.
And just getting them into their own safe place, like, really quickly, within 7 days, is essential for all kinds of reasons. For the obvious ones, just like your mental health, you know, like your feeling of worth and safety. So it's really rewarding work. It has been a challenging year, but there has been a number of upsides. As I said, it's forced us to focus on our digital marketing skills from a fundraising point of view, which is good. I think people, because they're at home and work from home, they're in front of the screen all day. So it's a good way to target people, you know, and tug on the heartstrings, I guess. I suppose the other thing is that there's been very few outbreaks amongst the homeless community and the shelters. And I think that if you think about that, that's a fairly impressive.
Very impressive, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it maybe makes people second guess about assumptions they may have had about that group of people, you know, like, you know, so those people are obviously concerned about their health and are taking, you know, the necessary precautions. I think they'll say, okay, like, these people are looking out for themselves, and can I do something to help them? So it's been challenging. It's been interesting. I'm lucky in that I'm involved in a charity that is really well organized and structured. And it's just, we have phenomenal people. Like, there's about 88 people work full time for Cork Simon. So it's a big organization. And I think that sometimes, like, don't get me wrong, volunteers are phenomenal. But I think we manage or control our own, whatever word you want, over 200 properties. You know, some of them have multiple units in them, and we engage with maybe 1,500 people on a regular basis. We run homeless nurses in Kerry, in the southeast of the country, in Waterford, Tipperary. So there's, they're just a phenomenal organisation. And I said, they're at it 50 years. So, like, any business that lasts 50 years, you know, you'll be getting a medal from the Lord Mayor, and, you know, you're on your third generation. That's great. And this is a charity that's done it. And it's while there is Simon Communities of Ireland, it's a wild thing. I think Cork Simon is... Cork people are just massively supportive of it.
Really, you know, supportive.
They see it as their own. And so it just makes it a pleasure to be involved, to be honest.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I love that it has changed so much over the years, where you're so proactive now. I love that you're doing all the future planning around the risk and making sure, as you say, that everybody has a house, everybody has a roof over their head.
Yeah, prevention.
And I love the campaign you're doing at the moment as well. It was just, there was so, oh, I mean, it's emotional because you have these stories that, you know, people are being interviewed who have been helped tremendously by Simon. So I think, you know, I was just watching a couple of videos and I think it's fantastic that you're doing that as well. So people can actually go onto your website, can't they, onto the Simon website for that, Ernest, and
yeah,
donate
or they can
directly.
Donate through or through Instagram or through Facebook or any of those platforms. There's donate buttons now as well.
Fantastic. Well, that's brilliant. And you're a dad of two now, Ernest, which is fantastic. And
It's a good buzz. It's funny, I have two little boys, four and two. They're both just born to their recent birthdays. So for you, go, my 2-year-old, I suppose he's been spoiled in that I'm at home a lot, you know, most evenings, all evenings, where else am I going to be going, but I'm not in work. So it's been a really nice time of their lives for this to happen to me. They're not in school, so they're not, you know, missing their friends as much of that kind of, you know, there's no home school or anything like that. So it's hit us, I suppose, at a nice time, and we're happy opening our own little bubble because it's, I would be off working and doing other things. And so it's,
I know, like it must be really nice for you because, I mean, you've been working late nights for a long time now as well.
Yeah. And it's funny that things, so my wife, she has a full-time job, she works from home, but also she's gone back to college by night. And that probably wouldn't have worked logistically for us if the places were open and I was working by night, you know, the small lads. Yeah. So there's, look, I wouldn't be naive enough to say that there's an upside to COVID, knowing the rotten time a lot of people have had, but there are certainly individual highlights. You know, there's some things that have just worked out. Yeah.
Agree. Yeah, I absolutely do. And I definitely think we've all started to look at kind of reconnecting within the home again, you know, which is fantastic.
Big time.
So that's lovely. You enjoy that because soon enough, Ernest, and with your plans as well for electric, the doors will be back open and you'll be in full swing again.
It's going to be busy.
It's going to be busy. So is that kind of the next for you, really, is just redesigning electric, getting the doors back open, going back into a pace of having a blended service offering, and of course continuing with Kinsale Spirit Company.
That's it. We've loads of Kinsale is funny in that business, in that there is it's just a whole industry. So you have pubs are going to be coming back and reopening. And you have, you know, multiple markets. So we're talking to quite a big company in the Czech Republic at the moment. It's just these random little opportunities come up, and even small things like this morning when you, just before we chatted, we were looking at POS, you know, point of sale.
Yeah.
So I was trying to decide, would we get baseball caps or beanie caps or bobble hats? You know, and what color are they going to be, and what brand are they going to be, and what are we going to, you know, like how many will we get, and should they be made in Ireland? Yeah. Does anybody make them in Ireland? So like this, there's all these little tangents, but it's a very nice business.
It's lovely,
In pubs, I suppose, and restaurants, you get to know your customer, and that's really nice.
But
most of them are from Cork or whatever. Whereas with this, well, you don't get that same connection. You know, you'd get, I'd get WhatsApps or, you know, from buddies, and they'd say, geez, just an off license in the States, and I've seen Kinsale, you know, or whatever.
Oh, that's lovely.
So it's different, but it has its own little nice, I wouldn't say like they're business highlights, but they're highlights for me. I get a kick out of them, like, you know.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Ernest, you're doing amazing. It was really good to catch up with you. Thanks a million for sharing your story today with us. I'm looking forward to following all your journey now as well. And thanks everyone for tuning in. As we said, you can follow Kinsale Spirit Company's journey on all their social media platforms. You can buy in most of the super values across Ireland. And as Ernest said earlier, they're now also across the States and in China. And also you can buy online. As we were talking about the Simon community as well, you can also donate through their social media platforms there or also through their website. As always, don't forget to like and share. Thank you, Red FM, for the production of this podcast. And we'll be back in a fortnight with another fantastic story of Cork producers and suppliers.
You've been listening to a Red FM podcast. For more extra content, go to redextra.ie.